Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amon 4. Here's what's coming up.
As a ceasefire deal stalls and fears of an Israeli incursion heighten in Rafah, I speak to journalist Amos Harel. Then, 11 years old and almost no family left, correspondent Jumana Karache meets orphans from Gaza facing a painful new reality. And UNICEF spokesperson James Elder joins me. Plus, Trump on trial. As Stormy Daniels takes the witness stand, we bring you the latest. And as Florida's six-week abortion ban takes effect, what does it mean for women there? I ask Planned Parenthood doctor Chelsea Daniels.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Bianca Goladriga in New York, sitting in for Christiane Amanpour, who will be back next week. Well, hope turned to despair overnight in Gaza. What you're seeing now are celebrations that were held in Rafah after Hamas announced that they'd agreed to a ceasefire deal yesterday. But this moment was short-lived. Israel soon announcing the terms of that deal didn't meet its demands and sending a delegation for further talks. This happens as the IDF is pushing into parts of Rafah, warning civilians to leave east of the area and taking control of the Gazan side of the Rafah crossing into Egypt. Visiting troops near the border, the Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said this operation will continue until Hamas is eliminated or hostages begin being returned. Meantime, Palestinians say more than 20 people were killed in overnight strikes, including six children. And many of Israel's allies and the United Nations are urging the nation to avoid a ground invasion. Joining me now on this is Amos Harel, longtime military correspondent and defense analyst for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. Amos, it's so great to see you. Thank you so much for joining us. You heard the comments there earlier from Defense Minister Gallant, where he said the operation in Gaza will continue until either Hamas is eliminated or the first hostage is returned. And that seems to be supported by your analysis, where you say the IDF's move thus must be seen as part of the ongoing negotiations for a ceasefire and hostage release. Do you think the IDF's actions going into Rafah right now, as limited as this incursion may be, will actually put more pressure and ratchet up the pressure on Hamas to finally agree to a deal? Or do you think there's a greater risk of sabotaging it?
I'm pretty sure that this is the intention. I think the scope of the operation has not been decided yet, and it will depend on what happens on the field. This is a rather limited operation. There are two Israeli brigades operating there since yesterday evening. They have moved ahead about 2 miles into Palestinian territory on a specific narrow corridor, which is called the Philadelphia Corridor, and is on the border of Egypt. And they haven't taken full control of the corridor, just the first third of it. They haven't moved into the city of Rafah itself. So this, to me, seems yet as a more of an Israeli threat, a military threat, but not the beginning of a major incursion. It will depend on what happens in Cairo. There is an Israeli delegation there discussing with the mediators, with the Qataris and the Americans and, of course, the Egyptians, the outcome of a possible deal.
Yeah, and to get to that specific deal and what Israel was looped in on or not, and now there's some reporting that Israelis felt blindsided not only by Hamas and Egypt, but by the United States as well, there seems to be some disagreement about the language itself and whether there's its parsing of words when you talk about substantial calm versus complete cessation of fighting and the withdrawal of the IDF as a whole. Reporter Barak Ravid Reid has said that his sources tell him, with knowledge of the negotiations, that the U.S. invited the Israelis to Cairo over the weekend, but they chose not to send a team. One Israeli official telling him that it admitted that that was a mistake on Israel's part to have less visibility of the talks. Would you agree with that assessment?
I tend to agree with Barak almost always. Yeah, I think this is the more or less the situation. I think the main issues where the sides have not reached an agreement yet have to do, as you said, with the outcome of the war. Will the deal itself lead to a full-scale ceasefire and a full Israeli withdrawal from the Gaza Strip? This is the main issue for Hamas, of course, because it would mean Hamas's continued survival. This is the big deal for Yahya Sinwar, the leader in Gaza. For the Israelis, and especially for Prime Minister Netanyahu, this could be quite an embarrassment, because it would mean that we have not reached the pronounced goals of the operation. After the horrific massacre of October 7th, Netanyahu announced that he was going to bring the hostages back, but also that he was going to annihilate the Hamas regime. This hasn't happened, and if he signs a deal now, it would mean he has to admit that he didn't achieve that goal. One more important point I think we should make has to do with the number of hostages being returned on the first stage of the deal. The number discussed is 33, but Hamas has been sending signals that it cannot actually reach the quota of 33 live hostages, and it might want to bring back some bodies of hostages that were either killed on October 7th or died while being in Hamas captivity. This is something that the Israelis could not live with, especially because Hamas refuses to release the full details about what happened to those hostages, and this could be a major obstacle reaching a deal.
Prime Minister Netanyahu, of past his prologue, it does seem like he's inclined to deny this deal as its stage for a number of reasons, perhaps his own political future and concern about his coalition and how some of the far right members of his coalition will react to this. That having been said, some members of his war cabinet, including those from the opposition, and that is Gadi Eisenkot and Benny Gantz, have said from day one that the sole issue for them and that will keep them in this coalition right now is the priority being the return of the hostages. Have we reached a point where they are either left with not living up to their words, or do you think there will come a point imminently where they will be forced to leave?
So Netanyahu is stuck between a rock and a hard place. If he moves forward with the deal, he may be facing a huge crisis with the far right parties in his coalition, Ben-Gvir's party and Bezalel Smotrich's party. On the other hand, Gantz and Eisenkot, who are on the left side or the center side of the government, do not seem too keen on leaving the government while the crisis is still ongoing. And they claim that in a number of occasions since the war began, they actually helped restrain some of the more dangerous trends among Israeli decision makers. And yet, especially Gadi Eisenkot, who lost his son Gal during the war while fighting for the release of the hostages, feels a huge moral obligation to the families of the Israeli hostages. So my guess is that if this does not move forward in the next month or so, and if Eisenkot believes that Netanyahu is to blame and not only Hamas, Eisenkot may decide to resign, may decide to leave the government, and he could even force Gantz, his partner, to leave along with him.
And that would lead to a huge political shakeup in the country, to say the least, and more cries for an imminent new round of elections. I was speaking yesterday with the mother, and this was a pre-scheduled interview with the mother of one hostage, Romy Gonen, and it was very difficult to have to break this news to her as it was happening in real time. And you see the pressure that these family members of the hostages are putting on this government day in, day out, with more and more protests. I want to turn to the question of Egypt, because we've seen a lot of condemnation, a lot of warnings from Israel's neighbors and allies, including the United States, about what this operation in Rafah will look like. How concerned are Egyptians about a potential spillover into Sinai, and what could that mean vis-a-vis the relationship between Egypt and Israel?
The Egyptians have been publicly and vocally very, very concerned since the first week of the war, when Israeli politicians began mentioning the possibility of pushing Gaza refugees towards Sinai, towards Egyptian territory. Everybody from General Sisi to his ministers warned Israel publicly not to even think of going in that direction. However, my sense is that in recent weeks, there has been a more tight coordination and better understanding between the Israelis and the Egyptians regarding Israel's actions. I don't think the Egyptians were surprised by what happened last night, by the fact that the Israelis went into the Philadelphia corridor and decided to take control of the Rafah crossing. As long as this doesn't spill over, as you have described it, as long as there are not tens of thousands of Palestinians refugees storming into Sinai, I think the Egyptians can live with that. And I think Israel has a point in blaming Egypt for some of what has happened, because for years and years and years, while Egypt declared itself as an ally and more or less of a friend to Israel, in spite of the disagreements over the Palestinian conflict, in reality, the Egyptians were turning a blind eye to the fact that Palestinians, especially Hamas, were smuggling thousands and thousands of weapons, rockets, mortar bombs, rifles, anything you can think of through that same Philadelphia corridor without Egypt actually intervening. And this is a very difficult point that the Israelis keep making. And I think that in a way, the Egyptians should help correct that situation, considering what everything that has happened.
Yeah, I believe the IDF said that they uncovered, or at least they said, I don't know if they showed proof of three tunnels that they've already found from Rafah going into Egypt. Almost help me square in our final moments here something that you wrote, and I always read what you write. It's mandatory reading. You said accepting the deal will not be an Israeli victory or a Hamas capitulation, but an Israeli recognition of the limits of power. Given that, and then given what we're hearing just now from John Kirby saying that the United States was hopeful Israel and Hamas could, quote, close the remaining gaps in the ceasefire talks, help me square how both can be aligned here.
I think that we should be realistic about this. Israel has been fighting this war for 7 months. We have encountered the worst day in Israeli history on October 7th. We have tried to correct that from our point of view. The IDF was quite successful at defeating Hamas brigades and battalions in the northern part and the central part of the Gaza Strip. But for the time being, it seems that it will take a very, very long time until we are able to defeat Hamas completely on the battlefield. And you can never defeat or annihilate completely an idea. And Hamas is about an ideology, a doctrine, a very aggressive ideology towards Israel, but this is not something that we can solve on our own quickly. So under these circumstances, I think there are benefits in moving towards a deal, even if we don't reach a final victory over Hamas, as Netanyahu keeps promising his political base. Will that actually happen in the next few weeks? I really hope and pray that this does happen, because especially I think from an Israeli perspective, I'm more than anything else, I'm worried about the hostages' lives and about the possibility of more Israeli lives lost. But I think that if the war goes on for a long time, it will create a huge international crisis for Israel. And this is something that we need to correct. On the other hand, I'm not so sure that Hamas would play along, since it has been so cynical about the whole crisis.
Especially if they think they have the upper hand here. Amos Harel, great to see you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
And when we come back, robbed of their childhood, CNN meets some of the 17,000 children who have been orphaned by the war in Gaza as they deal with unspeakable loss. Then UNICEF's global spokesperson James Elder on how an invasion of Rafah will make the crisis even worse for the people who are sheltering there.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support. your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome back. Well, today in Manhattan, Stormy Daniels, the adult film star at the heart of the election interference case against Donald Trump, is testifying for the prosecution. Daniels, whose real name is Stephanie Clifford, was paid $130,000 shortly before the 2016 election to keep quiet about her alleged affair with Donald Trump. Now, that payment is the basis of 34 counts of falsifying business records against the former president. Trump, we should note, denies any affair with Daniels. Norm Eisen is a CNN legal analyst and was a special counsel in Donald Trump's first impeachment trial, and he joins us now from outside the courthouse. So, Norm, it's interesting now. It's all come together because earlier this morning, the former president had taken to Truth Social to write something that he quickly then deleted about what he learned about one of the witnesses, and no one really knew who that was. And obviously, the judge's warning about violating the gag order and saying that he won't be stopped from putting him behind bars if that's what it took. I think it all makes sense now that we know who he was referring to, given Stormy Daniels up on the stand.
That's right, Bianna. And she proved to be a powerful witness, a complex one. But I thought, sitting in the courtroom, she was credible in describing the details of her 2006 sexual encounter with Donald Trump, and corroborating the details of what we've already heard from multiple witnesses, many documents about the critical alleged campaign finance crime that's at the center of this case, the 2016 payment to Ms. Daniels. On the whole, I thought prosecutors scored more points, and I can see why the former president was upset in that initial posting on social media that he put up and took down, because she did some damage to him and really helped establish the criminal case today.
Again, so remind our viewers, Trump has all along denied having an affair with her, though one just has to ask themselves why you would pay. I think it's Mitt Romney famously who said, why would someone pay $130,000 for an affair that never happened? Put that aside and explain for viewers why her testimony and why her involvement with Donald Trump is so crucial in this case.
This case is one for felony falsification of business records. And to have 34 counts that, if convicted, may carry jail time for the former president. In order to have a felony document falsification, you have to have some other crime or conspiracy that you cover up by creating false documents. In this case, the alleged criminal conduct is that this payment to Ms. Daniels in 2016 was over $100,000 more than permitted campaign contribution. And that the documents were falsified, 34 of them, to hide it in 2017. So she is at the crux of the underlying crime that is supposedly being covered up, and prosecutors are verifying every detail of that alleged criminal conspiracy with multiple witnesses, hundreds of documents, because as with Ms. Daniels, as we'll see on cross-examination, each of these witnesses is subject to being questioned and questioned severely. So they want to say, you don't have to believe any one person. There's a pile of evidence. And she provided quite a bit of it this morning.
So aside, Norm, from your legal expertise, it's so important for us to have you on as a guest because we don't have access to what is going on. We can't see what's going on inside the courtroom. Obviously, we have a sidebar that we show throughout most of our programming that details some and highlights some significant events and questions and exchanges in the trial. But you were actually in there. Tell us what the mood was like, what Donald Trump's demeanor was like. I believe I read that he mouthed an expletive at some point in response to one of her statements. Give us more color.
Well, probably the most important development was that Ms. Daniels is a loquacious witness. And she was answering some of the questions at length. And in particular, the judge had said that he did not want a lot of details about the sex itself back in 2006 to come in because of the prejudicial effect before the jury. And because that is, after all, although important context, not what this case is about. So the judge got a little impatient. And that is a plus for the defense. When the judge signals upheld a number of objections by the defense. So it was a little bumpier, not as smooth as we've seen with other witnesses. But nevertheless, as evinced by Trump's agitation, he slept at times, Bianna. Not today. He, for the most part, was paying attention. He looked at her. He looked away from her. He looked at the TV screens that we have inside the courtroom studying her. And then he became increasingly agitated because he could see the damage that she was doing, even though it was a little rocky. When we came back from the morning break, the judge said to Trump's lawyers, "Have you talked to your client?" And while we weren't privy to the sidebar, the private conversation with the judge and the lawyers that led to that, I think that that was most likely a message. Tell your client not to behave that way in front of the jury. And that has been a problem in the other civil trials of Donald Trump. So a great deal of drama in the courtroom today. Despite all of it, the basic bottom line is the prosecution is making its case through Ms. Daniels.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. Given how bumpy you said some of her testimony may have been, do you think net-net that she turned out to be, or at this point thus far, has been a credible witness for the prosecution and one that was worth them taking a risk to cross?
No question. You know, witnesses are differently attuned to the nuances of a courtroom. And she's a talker. And the judge, because he doesn't want some of these details, particularly the sexual details to come in, didn't want that. The basic takeaway, and I watch the jury closely. I look at Trump and I look at the jury and the witness who testifies. And of course, I've been watching juries for over three decades. I think the jury believed her. I think they were interested. You know, they have common sense and they understand witnesses can be nervous, yeah. Can break down in tears. We saw that with Hope Hicks, the president's former aide, on Friday. Sometimes witnesses are very smooth and consistent. David Pecker, who led off the case for the prosecution, right. Was a seamless witness. Sometimes they get into challenges on cross. We saw that with Keith Davidson, and the cross of Stormy Daniels will be interesting.
Yeah, sorry, Norm, we're just tight on time, but needless to say, I don't think there were many people sleeping during this testimony from Stormy Daniels in that courtroom today, to say the least. Norm Eisen, thank you.
Thanks, Bianna.
Well, next up for us, controversy and confusion as a six-week abortion ban takes effect in Florida. Dr. Chelsea Daniels says her patients know their bodies better than any politician, and she tells me why lives are being put at risk. That's when we're back. Welcome back. Well, it has been almost 1 week since abortion laws dramatically changed in Florida. A six-week ban is now fully in force, sending some women scrambling for care and doctors struggling to figure out how best to help their patients. Dr. Chelsea Daniels is an abortion provider in Miami, and she joins us now. Dr. Daniels, thanks so much for taking the time. So here we are, 1 week into this new law, and it's important to highlight just how draconian Florida's abortion laws have become since the overturning of Roe, because not so long ago, they were at 24 weeks, and that went to 15 weeks, and then here we are at 6 weeks. It's a large state that typically performed, I think, about 80,000 abortions a year. That accounts for 1 in 12 abortions nationwide. I know we're just 1 week in, but give us a sense of what you've seen and what's happened in that state in those few days.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on to discuss this. I cannot overstate the importance of having these conversations because you said it, these laws are draconian and they are being imposed on patients and on communities by people who are not medical providers and do not have the medical or scientific background to be making these kinds of decisions on behalf of patients. What I have seen in the past week is terror and confusion and anger, all as patients are trying to access basic essential healthcare. We are unfortunately having to redirect dozens of patients. We have already had to redirect dozens of patients over the past week or so. And I just imagine that we're going to continue to have those kinds of really challenging conversations.
And redirecting patients isn't just going to another county. I mean, we should note that the closest state they can now go to is some 800 miles away, and that is North Carolina, who has laws that extend beyond 6 weeks. At this point, prior to this law going into effect, it was actually Florida that was a destination state for many women in the South that had already been dealing with newly enforced legislation. Give us just any anecdotes that you can of what this experience is like, the real impractical, you know, ability for women to be able to go from Florida to North Carolina to get medical treatment.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that's a really good point you make. Florida is geographically isolated. So to get to the next nearest state where care is available, that's North Carolina, and that's about a 15-hour drive. And North Carolina has a 72-hour waiting period and only provides care to 12 weeks. So this is not an easy ask for patients. I saw a patient just yesterday who was about 8 weeks pregnant, was in a state of shock. She only had just found out that she was pregnant. She wanted us to remeasure and remeasure because she was like, I can't leave. I can't take off work. I have a newborn at home. I don't have the days off. I don't have the ability to get myself to North Carolina. What can I do? And we have resources and funds for her, but we can't ask her employer to give the days off work. This is really an unimaginable ask for people for what is just basic healthcare.
And you're already having these conversations.
Every day. Have been having them for the last week. We had them under the 15-week ban. We have them under any kind of abortion ban because we know that all abortion restrictions do is marginalize our most marginalized and make it more difficult to access what is basic essential health care. And that includes abortion.
So we should note, by the way, this isn't just a woman issue. This is an issue that affects families and for many generations, because at times there's a father involved, they're the grandparents that have to step in and help. So this just isn't relating to women who happen to be pregnant. This speaks to a larger community and population that's affected just because of the 6 week ban, when again, most women don't even know they're pregnant at 6 weeks. There are exceptions for abortions before 15 weeks, and that includes rape, incest, or human trafficking. But is it true that women have to show proof?
That is absolutely true. And that's why I hesitate to even use the word exception. What is an exception when you have to provide legal documentation of a crime to your doctor in order to receive medical care? I simply can't think of any other branch of medicine or any other patient encounter where a patient is being asked to show legal proof of a crime in order to receive care. And the sad reality is that most folks who are raped or are the victim of incest or are trafficked are unlikely to report because it is really challenging to report and something horrible has already happened to them. And now they have to report and then show these documents to a provider all before 15 weeks of pregnancy. It just is unrealistic. It is misogynistic, and it is just simply asking too much of our communities. And all it does is restrict reproductive freedoms. It restricts our abilities to make decisions about ourselves that affect our lives, our bodies, our futures.
And what position does it put doctors in who now face legal liability for making decisions when, you know, I hate to say that it may be subjective to figure out when a mother's life is at risk or when it's not, and what qualifies as something that's risky. And maybe her life won't be at risk, but maybe she won't be able to carry a baby again if an abortion isn't conducted. Because we also have to remind people that it's not just women who are seeking to terminate. Some of these women just can't, and they're facing challenges or health issues. What bind does that put
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hospitals and doctors like yourself in.
Yeah, that's a great point too. And this is something we've seen play out in Florida already under a 15-week ban, and we've seen play out across the country in places where there are restrictions. Anytime we put restrictions on abortion, restrictions on essential basic health care, and these restrictions are written by non-medical providers, it makes it impossible for a medical provider such as myself to interpret the language and to try to balance, okay, on the one side, I know what is medically and clinically indicated, but on the other side, I have legal language that I am struggling to interpret that is trying to govern my care. And I think what we see is that that leads to devastating outcomes for patients. There are countless stories of patients being turned away for a medically indicated abortion procedure because doctors and hospitals and institutions are too fearful to act because of these draconian and murky laws. So I think we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that what has played out in other states is going to play out in Florida and has already played out. I think we've all heard of the patient Anya Cook, who had her water broke early in pregnancy, and she, until she was hemorrhaging and on the brink of death from infection, she was denied care.
Quickly, in the final few seconds we have, what is the state's role, law or policy with regards to mifepristone now?
So mifepristone is still legal and totally safe, but because of a 6-week abortion ban, we cannot prescribe mifepristone or misoprostol, the second combination of an abortion medication regimen, beyond 6 weeks of pregnancy.
So it's still the 6-week limit?
6-week limit. No matter the method, yeah. 6 weeks is what the law is telling us.
Dr. Chelsea Daniels, thank you for your time and help
thank
to
you
explain
so much.
Us the situation there in Florida now. And finally for us, President Biden has used a major speech at a Holocaust remembrance ceremony in Washington to denounce rising anti-Semitism. Take a listen.
This ancient hatred of Jews didn't begin with the Holocaust. It didn't end with the Holocaust either, or after, even after our victory in World War II. This hatred continues to lie deep in the hearts of too many people in the world and requires our continued vigilance and outspokenness. That hatred was brought to life on October 7th in 2023. On the sacred Jewish holiday, the terrorist group Hamas unleashed the deadliest day of the Jewish people since the Holocaust. That's why I'm calling on all Americans to stand united against anti-Semitism and hate in all its forms. My dear friend, and he became a friend, the late Elie Wiesel said, quote, "One person of integrity can make a difference." We have to remember that now more than ever.
Well, back in 2015, Christiane spoke to Holocaust survivor, Nobel laureate Elie Wiesel. He told her there would never be adequate words to describe the horrors of the Nazi death camps.
You know, obviously, with each passing year, the number of Holocaust survivors gets smaller, gets less. And people ask, who's going to remember and who is going to remind? And I also, you know, have read so many stories of people who say they could never talk about this until they were later in life, survivors who wanted to get on with building their own life and building a new life. What made you talk and write, and how long did it take you after liberation to be able to tell about this?
Well, it took me 10 years. I knew I was going to write. I had written before, but I had written about mysticism. I was a youngster. I was 12, 13, and I went back to my hometown and found my manuscript that I had written at age 12, 13 on Jewish mysticism, of all things. And I knew I was going to write. But I knew one day I will have to write, and I didn't find the words. I was afraid that I will not find them. I'm not even sure, by the way, that I did find them. Maybe there are no words for what happened. Mm-hmm. Maybe somehow the Germans, which means the cruel killers, have succeeded at least in one way. That means they deprived us, the victims, of finding the proper language of saying what they have done to us, mm-hmm. because there are no words for it.
Elie Wiesel passed away after an illness in 2016 at the age of 87. His words obviously more important now than ever, one could say. Well, that is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you so much for watching, and goodbye from New York.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.